Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Bob Lefsetz podcast. My guest today is guitarist and songwriter extraordinaire Eric Bazilian. You'll know him from the Hooters, also as a songwriter of Joan Osborne's One of Us, Bon Jovi songs, Billy Meyer's Kiss the Rain. We'll go on and on. Eric, how you doing?
I'm great, Bob. Thanks.
So let's start from the beginning. You live in Sweden, correctly?
I live in Stockholm now. I've been living there since the summer. I've spent every summer there since I met my wife in 93. And then every other Christmas, done a couple of full years, but we decided to do it again.
Now, did she meet you based on your fame?
Absolutely not. She sat next to me on a flight from JFK to Stockholm. We were on our way to do a festival by the North Pole. She had lived in LA for a bunch of years, moved back to Sweden, went back to LA to keep her green card active and see if the ex-boyfriend was a thing.
Still. Right.
We sat next to each other, exchanged phone numbers, stayed in touch, found myself back there a few weeks later, and, you know, it happened, and
rest is history. So you've been in bands, but most specifically the Hooters, who are still together. Is who the members married to, does that affect the harmony of the band?
It really can, yeah. I mean, I was married, what I call my training marriage, before this, and she was also our band stylist, visual director. So she's responsible for those colors that we wore. And that got weird. It complicated things a lot.
Okay, so you're from Philadelphia.
I am from Philadelphia.
Okay, how did you first get into music?
I saw the Beatles on Ed Sullivan.
No, before the Beatles.
Oh, before that.
Were you into music at all before the Beatles?
Well, my mom was like a child prodigy concert pianist.
Really?
She went to Curtis when she was nine.
Really?
The famous Curtis Institute.
Yes.
And she was studying at the University of Pennsylvania. She met my father when she was 18, got married, had me, and—
Okay, wait, did she finish college or did she drop out when she met your father?
She finished college in 1984.
Wow.
Yep.
Wait, did she finish at Penn?
She did. She graduated Penn after I did.
So what motivated her to go back?
She and my dad got divorced when I was 21, and so she wanted to, you know, find herself, and she apparently, I don't remember this, but apparently she asked me, you know, what do you think I should study? And I said, well, because my mother, even though she was a musician, had a serious scientific bent about her. So I said, well, how about science? How about anthropology? So she ended up majoring in physical anthropology.
That's unbelievable. So your parents get divorced when you're 21. I have a very good friend whose parents got divorced right after we graduated from college. It really messed them up. Did it mess you up?
I didn't think it did at the time. In retrospect, yeah, it did. I mean, it shakes the foundation. But, you know, I wasn't living at home.
Right.
But, you know, yeah, I think on some level it definitely did.
So— Since she's a concert pianist, did she introduce you? Did she make you take piano lessons as a little kid?
She didn't make me. I asked her for them.
Did she used to play the piano in the house?
All the time. And I would sit next to her while she was rocking Chopin.
Really?
And I would, you know, that was really my first rock experience. Even though she was playing Chopin, I would just see the way, you know, her eyes would roll up into her head and she would, you know, I want that.
Did she also play records in the house?
Not that much. But then my uncle, my father's brother, played guitar. He was a folk musician.
Really?
Yep.
Of any noted?
No. But he taught me my first guitar chords and my first song on the guitar. The first song that I ever learned to play and sing was El Preso Número 9 by Joan Baez, and I learned it in Spanish.
And how old were you?
I was 9 or 10. I think I was 10 at that point.
Okay, so you start playing piano at what age?
6, probably.
Okay, and when you pick up the guitar at what age?
Not 8 or 9, probably 9.
And so you were taught how to read music. To this day, can you read music?
I was taught to try to read music. It's like I learned the alphabet, but I could never like make music out of it. I've had a recent experience with reading because someone showed me a video of Chris Thiele doing a Bach solo violin sonata on mandolin. Now, mandolin... Here's a mandolin.
Okay.
My career basically in the United States began with these chords. Da, 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 da. So I owe a lot to the mandolin, but I never really addressed it as a serious instrument. It was a little spice in the Hooters arsenal of sounds. Someone showed me this video of Chris Thiele playing this Bach piece, and I said, I'm going to learn that. And this was right when we had moved to Stockholm, and I walked into the famous Hellstones music store, and he had just gotten in this 1935 Gibson mandolin. The price was right. I didn't have a mandolin in Sweden. Bought the mandolin, went home, downloaded the sheet music, printed it out, and that was early September, and I am still struggling to play this piece. But I can kind of read a little bit now.
Wow. So, okay, you're playing guitar and piano a little bit, and then are you listening to the Transistor? Philly has some legendary radio stations.
Yeah. Oh, I listened to, you know, it's funny, the Beatles weren't the first thing that shook my, rocked my world.
That's my question. So what was?
Ironically, the first record I ever bought was...
We can't play the song too long because we get into publishing issues.
Right, I forgot. Well,
but that was certainly good, yes, but continue the
story. So the first song I learned was Sukiyaki,
right,
which is really called Uyo Mui to Aruko by Kyu Sakamoto. And I would stay home from school, feign illness, to listen to the radio to hear that song, which they were playing every hour.
Okay, your father was a psychiatrist,
yes,
right? He didn't realize you were feigning illness?
No, he didn't notice.
And how many siblings do you have?
None.
None. You're the old. There's a lot of pressure on you.
Yeah.
Okay, so the Beatles, it's February of 64.
February 9th.
The Beatles come on, Ed Sullivan. How does that change you?
My parents had gone to Baltimore to look at a Steinway for my mom, and I opted to stay home because I wanted to watch the Beatles. So I went over to our friend Bernie's house. You know, they walked out, they did All My Lovin'. And you know,
right.
Wow. And I remember when they got...
I remember because underneath it, they put the status of all the people. And under John, it says, sorry girls, he's married.
I think it was either at that point or I Want to Hold Your Hand where I realized I want to be him. First, I looked at Paul because Paul was cute and dark haired and I wanted to be him. And then I looked at George, who was playing the solo for Till There Was You, and I said, no, I want to be him. Then I saw John, who was like the coolest guy alive. I said, no, I want to be him. And then I saw Ringo, and no one had more fun than Ringo. No, I realized I wanted to be all four of them.
Okay, so then what happened next?
So what happened next was the next day Bernie and I started our first band. Bernie was going to play drums.
And once again, Bernie's your best friend?
My best friend.
Okay, Bernie had any musical experience?
None whatsoever.
Okay, and did you start said band?
We did. We did it with our friend Paul. So it was a trio. I called us the Limestones, like the Quarrymen.
Okay.
And so before this had happened, and I had learned to play this Joan Baez song, my uncle knew a guy named Gene London who had a local kids show in Philadelphia, and I performed on that show.
So, you perform playing the guitar and singing the song?
Playing the guitar and singing the song.
Well, that's pretty dramatic.
Unfortunately, the tapes are long gone.
Right.
But he brought us back. So the Limestones performed on the Gene London Show. We did A Hard Day's Night and House of the Rising Sun.
I mean, I'm speechless. So in high school, you must have been the biggest thing going.
No. This is 1964, 65. So I was getting the crap kicked out of me because I had long hair.
Wow. You went to public school or private school?
I went to public school through sixth grade.
Okay.
And then I went to private school.
But you didn't get your ass kicked.
I actually did in private school.
Really? That's
yeah. I went to
thing.
A Quaker school, and I thought, oh, I'm going to be no. It all changed in like ninth grade, and like the guy who was kicking my ass in eighth grade suddenly is like my biggest defender.
Okay, so you see the Beatles, you need an electric guitar and the amplifier.
I wanted to play bass because I wanted to be like Paul first. So
right.
I got a, a Dan Electro bass for $80.
Okay, $80 your parents give you?
I had saved it.
Okay.
And I got the bass, we thought that Paul, who knew a couple of chords, was going to play guitar. Well, Paul couldn't play guitar. So Paul played bass. I played guitar. And
Where'd you get a guitar?
No, Paul had a guitar. He had a Supro.
Okay.
He had like a $30
And you
guitar.
Had amps too?
I think we had one amp.
Okay.
Between us, which is what the Beatles had.
Right.
For a while. And we did the TV show. And then that sort of never really caught fire. Well, it wasn't until I was around 15 that my first real band gelled. It was still Bernie right. And I. And then there was a kid that I went to Hebrew school with.
Okay.
Named Paul Vernick, who kept trying to get me to play with him, but he was such a nebbish. He was just like, come on, man. I can sing. I can play. Okay, fine. And then Bernie, it turns out he went to high school with Bernie. And Bernie said, you know, this kid's really good. So we got, the three of us got together. By this point, Bernie's playing bass. We get a drummer. This kid opens, Paul opens his mouth, and I'm like, oh God, this is like, you know, Steve Winwood, Paul McCartney. This was like the voice. And he played great rhythm guitar and he wrote songs. So we had our first real band at 15, 16. It was called Evil Seed. And I just got in touch with the guy who managed us back then, got in touch with me. He had recordings, which I thought were all gone.
Wow. Where are Paul and Bernie today?
Paul is no longer with us. He had substance issues, which ultimately took him away. Bernie is in Northern California living a real life, having a real job, still playing bass. We get together sometimes and it's like we are one brain with four hands.
Okay, so you have Evil Seed, you're 15 years old. What happens next musically?
You know, we start getting really good and then they come over to the house and fire me because I have another year of high school left. I was a year younger, and I was also taking pictures. I was really into photography at that point as well. I don't know whose idea it was, but they fired me. And then 3 months later, they came back, cap in hand, and said, sorry, man, would you come back?
And did you go back?
I did, because it really was a great band. I mean, I listened.
How much were you working in terms of, you know, playing like bar mitzvah parties and stuff like that?
Someone actually did hire us for a bat mitzvah, and they shut us down after the first song. They did not want to hear Cream and Hendrix covers.
So this was a band you played in the basement or in the party room, but you didn't play out.
We did. We played, you know, coffee houses. There was one legendary coffee house called Hecate's Circle, like Hecate, the goddess. Where a lot of weird shit went down, but I managed to stay away from all that.
So this band, Evil Seed, takes you all the way through high school?
All the way through high school, yep.
And then you yourself go to Penn.
Then I myself go to Penn. Band kind of breaks up. At this point, Paul has already had his substance issues have already gotten the better of him, and it turns out that there are other mental health things involved. So, I go off to Penn, and my first week there, I go to an electronic music class that they have. They have a Moog synthesizer, serial number 003.
Wow.
And I see this guy in there with really long blonde hair down to his waist, and I recognize him. He's in another Philly band called Wax that I've seen open for the Birds. And we start talking and hanging out, and it turns out that his band Wax, guitar player had left. At that point, their configuration was two electric pianos, two drummers, a bass player, and a singer. And I'm like, put me in. So I joined that band, and that was challenging because he was at that point, Rob Hyman was like, that was Rob. Yeah.
Okay. Challenging because of his personality or because you weren't up to snuff musically?
I was up to snuff, but I really did have to up my game. Musically, it was really some sophisticated music. It was even then, we're talking now like September 71.
Okay, so you join that band. How much time goes to that band as opposed to school?
A lot. In fact, I basically almost flunked out second semester, freshman year.
But you graduated a physics major, right?
Yeah.
By anybody's standards, physics is not easy.
You know, I'm wired funny, I guess. I was getting C's in history courses and A's in physics.
Really?
Yeah.
It just comes naturally to you.
It didn't. I had to work hard, but if I worked hard, I'd get it. And the feeling of satisfaction was similar to learning a piece of music. You know, that understanding Newton, understanding Einstein. There was a moment, you know, those magic eye paintings?
Yeah.
For me, it was like that. I would stare at a problem and stare at a problem, and all of a sudden, I would see it clearly. And then if I looked away, it would disappear.
Okay, the obvious question people would ask today is, you have anything to do with physics today?
Not externally, but I think internally, my process, the way my subconscious mechanism works, I think it's the same thing.
Well, I was going to ask that question second, so you certainly answered it. But what people don't get today when, and it's funny because it's our generation and even younger generations, they send their kids to school as a glorified trade school to get a job. Where when we went, our parents said, if you go and you graduate, we don't care what you study.
Right. That's what mine said.
Exactly. So you are now playing with Rob in this band Wax. To what degree do you have a dream of further success?
That's all I really want to do. In the meantime, I took all the pre-med requirements and, you know, got my degree. Rob graduated 3 years before I did. So he and the singer, David, went off and just kept writing songs. Meanwhile, Rick Chertoff, who was the drummer in that band, goes and gets a job for Clive Davis as an A&R slash producer. His first act of A&R heroism is he finds Mandy for Barry Manilow.
By Clive's terms, that's a huge victory.
Yeah, well, by anybody's terms. I mean, really. I mean,
Clive is always about, when you would go for a meeting with Clive, when he would want to hire somebody, he would say, bring in five songs that are out there that you believe right. will be covered and be hits.
That's exactly what he, I think that was one of them. I think Peaceful Easy Feeling was one.
Wow.
I think Mandy came later. I don't think that was an audition song.
So Rick goes off there and you're left at Penn doing what?
Studying physics, and I had a band. You know, my roommate, who I'd known from high school years, he had a Hammond organ, and then we found some other guys. We had a band called Cyclic Blowfield and His Funky Calypsos.
Definitely the 70s. And to what degree were you known in Philadelphia?
Not at all. We played frat parties, VFW.
To what degree was there a scene in Philly at that point?
There wasn't. That's the thing. There really wasn't much of a scene.
You have the famous Tower Theater where David Bowie cut his live album, so there was a live music scene, but none of the local people were populating that.
The Tower didn't really start going until the mid-70s.
Right.
You know, 73, 74, even 75. There was the Spectrum.
Right.
And
where the roof blew off.
Where the roof, yeah. That's, yep.
For those who don't know, that's a famous arena in Philadelphia. So the roof blows off the Spectrum, but were you an avid concert goer yourself?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I was a photographer, too.
Did you have a dream of being successful, to be the Annie Leibovitz?
No, I had a dream of being John, Paul, George, and Ringo. But in the meantime, I enjoyed taking pictures of these people. And I loved being in the darkroom. I loved printing them.
So it was purely a hobby.
Yeah, yeah. Except that at that point, bands would play two nights at the Electric Factory. They'd play Friday and Saturday. I'd go down Friday, first in line, get right up front, which is literally pushed up against the stage, which is about a yard high. Shoot, go home, develop the negatives, let them dry overnight. Spend all day printing, go back down, get first in line, and sell prints to kids online.
So you were obviously dedicated. You would sell them to the people in line. How much would you sell them for?
Buck and a half maybe.
How big were the prints?
5x7, 8x10.
Really?
Yeah.
And what was somebody supposed to do with the print during the show?
Yeah, you know, nobody ever asked me that. But then I started handing them to the bands on stage. People would come out. Someone would come out and say, would the individual who handed those photographs to Rod Stewart please come backstage?
And did you meet Rod Stewart?
I did. And Ronnie Wood. It was the first Faces tour. And like an idiot, I sold the negatives to them.
Wow, Rod Stewart was so cool back then.
He was amazing.
So those were the first rock stars you met, or did you met other people?
That was them. Jeff Beck. 10 years after. I really went after 10 years after because I wanted to be Alvin Lee.
Right.
And I actually got to be friends with them because I was 15, 16, but I looked 12.
Right.
My voice didn't change until I was 16.
So this begs the question, greatest guitarist in rock history?
That's a pantheon. I mean, I have my favorites for different things. George Harrison, obviously, because he was the first guitarist that had parts. He really played orchestrally.
Right.
Then came the Holy Trinity, Clapton, Beck, and Hendrix.
Okay, of those, how do you rank those three? Or are they unrankable?
They're kind of unrankable. I say technically Beck,
right,
hands down. If you like pentatonic blues, Clapton, revolutionizing the guitar as a world, Hendrix.
Okay, so let's go back. So Rick Chertoff's in New York working for Clive, and Rob is playing in his own band because he graduated 3 years before.
Well, he and David, the singer, are just writing songs so that Rick can sign them to Arista.
Okay.
Right when I'm about to graduate, they get signed.
Right, that's Baby Grand.
That's Baby Grand. So, again, it's a keyboard player and a singer. They need a guitar player.
Okay, so were you in touch with them when they called you?
I stayed in touch all through.
Okay, so you called. So you must have thought you made it.
I thought, this is it. You know, I'm gonna make a lot of money right away, and, you know, we're going to go on the road and all that great stuff that goes along with it.
And then what happens?
Well, we're still working on the songs. And you know, Rob's playing me these songs, and... You know, the thing about meeting Rob was I met my equal.
Okay.
You know, I mean, Paul, who was in Evil Seed, was an amazing songwriter, singer, but Rob, you know, his musicality just was on another level. I mean, really, it was, to me, it was like Steely Dan on steroids. The way his sense for chord changes and melodies, and David, who wrote all the lyrics then. So it really, really challenged me. And it made me up my game, especially when it was time to arrange these songs and come up with signature guitar parts. And I would come up with the instrumental sections. I'd go off in Woodshed and come back with this, you know, 3-minute exploration. And they loved it. Because you could do that then.
Yeah. Listen, nothing better than having your work be loved. So you make the record. Who produced that record?
Rick and Rob.
Okay. And the record comes out. I happen to own that record where you're not on the cover and you got the person made out of vegetables.
Oh, that's the second album.
Oh, that's the second album. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I own the first.
The first one has a Botero painting.
I have to go back to my collection. I certainly remember the second. So you get to make two records. But by my standards, nothing really happens with either of those records.
No, no. I mean, we had a couple of shows where it really felt like it was happening, and afterwards we're going, we're the next Beatles. But no, it didn't happen. I think we were 10 years ahead of our time or 10 years behind. But we our first album came out when Talking Heads was happening.
Right.
And it was, everything was going minimal, and if you could play really well, you kind of had to hide it, whereas I'm playing like I'm getting paid by the note.
But Clive is amenable. He's behind it.
He's behind it, but you can tell he's like, Rick was his pet A&R guy, so we'll let Rick have his fun with these guys. But after we did the second album and we started writing songs for the third, and by this point, Rob and David had brought me in as a full member of the band,
right?
And brought me into the songwriting process, and we started writing songs and sending them to Clive, and Clive kind of sat us down and said, "Guys, you know what a hit song sounds like." And he played us actually something that he thought was going to be a hit song, which was really lame.
And it wasn't a hit.
It was not a hit. No, but you know what? Nobody bats 1,000.
Right.
Even Clive doesn't take away from anything.
So we sit you down and...
And we just realize this is not the place for us. And then at some point, Rob and I realized that it wasn't going to happen. The style of music we were doing, the singer wasn't a rock star. And he even told us, he said, I wasn't born to rock.
Right.
So Rob and I decided to give it one more shot. This is 79 now. We're going to have one more band. What are we going to do? How are we going to make it into something that everyone else isn't doing? Because we're not going to do punk because we're just way beyond that. At this point, the ska invasion was happening.
Of course.
So, we saw Madness. We saw The Selector. We saw The Specials. The Police were happening. And Rob actually grew up going to Jamaica as a kid, and he was way into reggae. So he said, you know what? No American bands are doing this ska thing. Let's try that.
Okay.
And we had already found a drummer. Originally, we were going to do it as a three-piece. I mean, Rob and I looked at each other, and I said, can you sing? I don't know. Can you? I don't know. Well, let's try it. At least if we sing together, at least we can cover each other's asses. And we originally were going to do it as a three-piece. Rob was going to play left-hand bass like Ray Manzarek.
Right.
But then the drummer was in a band which was breaking up because the lead singer and lead guitarist were leaving. So I went and subbed with them, with that band. They had a 2-week commitment at this club. And I realized, here's a great drummer, a great bass player, a great guitarist. We'll bring them in.
Okay.
And that became the Hooters, the original Hooters.
So this is 1979.
This is, at this point, it's 80. This is January
1980, 80. And you're living in New York or you're living in Philly?
Oh, Philly. I never left Philly.
Okay. And what's the next step with the Hooters?
Next step with the Hooters is to write some songs, get a band name, and get some gigs.
Now, the band is named after the Melodica?
Yeah. Well, what happened was we went in to do our first demos, and my friend Glenn, who's actually sitting out there in the control room, had a melodica.
Right.
Rob and I, being into reggae, were listening to a lot of Augustus Pablo. He would just play a melodica over these tracks. And Rob said, "Wow, we should try a melodica." I said, "Well, my buddy Glenn's got one." And in the meantime, a friend of ours had a mandolin, and he also happened to have some recording gear. So he recorded our first demos. So we're setting up for the first demos. I'm playing a mandolin. Better than that.
Right.
But and then the engineer says, "Give me a level on that Hooter."
Ah, okay.
And we looked at each other and went, "Okay, well, this is a Hooter. This is a Hooter." The band name thing took a few days because we wanted to be a plural noun. so that each guy in the band could say, I am a
right.
Beatle, Rolling Stone. Not a shoe, not a chair. It couldn't be a household name. And then it dawned on one of us that it could be a Hooter.
So you become the Hooters, and what's the next step towards success?
Rob's girlfriend at the time had a successful record store, like alternative punk new wave record store, and she took it upon herself to manage us with Rob, and we had a very successful marketing campaign. We printed up, she made a logo for us, and printed up a bunch of yellow 8.5 by 11 sheets of paper that said HOO ? And we papered them all over the city.
Right. That's a good campaign. I got to give her credit.
And then a week later, Hooters. And then the date of our first show, which was, I think, June of 1980 at a bar in Levittown.
And was it successful? Did people show up?
People showed up. Well, because the band that I had played in with David, our drummer, had a following. So they knew David and they knew me.
Right.
And yeah, they came, 100 maybe the first night, 200 the second night. And we ended up playing at a bar called Vernon's 5 nights a week, 4 sets a night.
Oh, really?
So that was like our Hamburg.
Right, exactly. I was thinking. So how do you end up getting a deal with Columbia?
Oh, that was a long road.
Really?
Yeah, we did Vernon's, places like that. Then we started doing a residency at a place called Grendel's Lair in the city on South Street in Philly every Monday night. So again, the first time maybe we had 75 people, second time 150, and within a few months, the line was around the block. Then a very lucky thing happened. A disc jockey named Michael Tiersen.
I hear from Michael Tiersen all the time.
Of course you do. Of course you do. He decides he's going to put the studio on lockdown and only play the music he wants to play. Guerrilla Radio,
he called it.
That was the original Guerrilla Radio. So Betsy, the manager, calls him and says, hey, we got some demos. Should we come down? He says, yeah. So he plays our first demo. It was a ska instrumental called Man in the Street. He plays it, and I guess the phones went wild because they started playing it like in regular rotation. Now, this is WMMR.
Right.
This isn't like, you know, cheesy little.
That's one of the original so-called underground FM rock stations.
Yep. It was the second one.
Right.
You know, things just kind of, and then we put out our first single. We did a live broadcast. We opened for the Beat, for the English Beat, who are our heroes.
Right, Mirror in the Bathroom.
Oh, my God. And we opened for them, and we did a live version of All You Zombies, which they started playing and started really playing it. So we put that out as our second single.
Okay.
So things are really heating up. We're really getting gigs, and it's spreading out into the, into Jersey, into Delaware. But what happens in Philly stays in Philly. You know, you go to New York to try to get somebody interested. Well, come play New York.
Right.
So you go, I think the place was called Privates, and 10 people show up. You know, the A&R geniuses come out and say, well, it wasn't electric.
Right.
Well, you try being electric in front of 10 people.
Hey, it's Bob Lefsetz. I thank you for your time. Welcome to my new podcast, the Bob Lefsetz Podcast. Remember to subscribe on TuneIn, iTunes, or wherever you get your podcasts. So the Cyndi Lauper record was before the Hooters deal.
Yes.
Okay. Rick calls you. Rick's the producer of that. And what does he say?
He says—
because she's already come from failure and bankruptcy.
Right. He says, and he was basically assigned her.
Okay.
And he says, I got this artist. And he took her to see a number of musicians. And apparently she didn't like me at first. She liked Rob, but she wasn't nuts about me.
Okay.
So it was originally going to be another guitar player, but then I don't know if Rick talked her into it or if she saw us again and decided I was up to snuff. But we started hunkering down in we had this rehearsal studio that we called The Ranch. But it was like not a ranch. It was like—
You're in Philadelphia. I mean, realize it's not a ranch.
It was really like Deliverance World.
Right.
Around there. And Rick had his suitcase full of songs. He had Girls Just Want to Have Fun.
Well, that's a Robert Hazard song from Philadelphia. Yeah. Did you know Robert?
Yeah. Oh, sure. He was our competition. He was our rival.
He had that one thing, he had that song, The Elevator of Life, which
Escalator.
I loved. Escalator of Life. He talked about taking his Mazda to the supermarket. He's dead himself at this point in time.
Yes, he is.
So, okay, he had that. And then where do Time After Time and all that stuff come from?
Time After Time was a later rival.
Okay.
Girls Just Want to, am I allowed to play any of Girls Just Want to Have
Yeah,
Fun?
But keep it short.
Okay. This was how it was originally written.
Okay.
I come home in the middle of the night, my father.
It was I haven't heard the original version.
Okay. So Cindy
said, and it was Boys Just Want to Have Fun.
No, it was Girls Just Want to Have
it,
Fun.
Was it really?
Yes, it was. But Cindy said, I will never sing that song. That song is, I don't like the music and it's demeaning to women. So we tried doing it as a reggae. We tried doing it as a ska. We tried doing it as a Cat Stevens thing. She was not having any of it. But Rick, who is really an A&R genius, he knew that that voice singing that song was gold. So finally, one day we came in and Rick's like, can't we figure out a way to do this? Now, this was when Come On Eileen was all over the world.
Right.
And who didn't love Come On Eileen?
Of course.
So Cindy says, can't you make it sound like Come On Eileen? And I remember that I have such a clear visual memory of that moment. I had an 808 drum machine. That's what we did all of the demos with.
Of course, TR-808.
And I turned that big tempo knob down. I changed the kick drum pattern. I picked up my guitar and I went.
Does that easy?
Yeah, that's.
What's it like when you hear that riff that you just come off that easy when it became ubiquitous all over TV and radio? Did that kind of just, like, blow your mind?
It was pretty wacky. I mean, it was, I probably felt like Raphael Ravenscroft felt whenever he
right, right.
Baker Street, because I got paid about as much as he did for that.
Right, right.
But, of course, a week later, she's saying, you know, I always wanted to sing that song. That song is so empowering to women.
Listen, I'll leave it in today's environment. I won't make any comment about that. So you're making that record. How long does it take to make that album?
We spent about 6 months demoing the songs that Rick had brought in. A couple of them Cindy had co-written. There was a Jules Shear song. There was
right.
all through the night. And then we went into the record plant.
And okay, you make the record. You have any idea it's going to be this gigantic smash, which it turns out to be?
I was really sort of running on fumes creatively at that point. Cindy's brilliant. I love her. She's like that wacky cousin that you like have Thanksgiving with, and you're tired afterwards. But
right.
But she's great. I mean, I think she's one of the greatest singers ever, and a fine, fine person. But it was draining. And then towards the very end, Rick was saying, you know, we could really use a couple more songs. And Cindy was reading TV Guide looking for titles. So she found two titles, Vertigo and Time After Time. I got Vertigo. We tried to write a song called Vertigo. It wasn't good. She and Rob, meanwhile, come to me a couple days later and say, hey, we got an idea for a song. They play me the chorus, like a verse idea and a chorus. And I just said, you've just written Yesterday.
Right.
We're gonna hear this song for the rest of our lives.
And who created the arrangement?
That was really me and Rob and Rick and Bill Whitman, who was the engineer and is now Cindy's musical director for 15 years.
So, but the album comes out and goes nuclear. Did you foresee that
no,
at all?
No, I remember when I got my first pressing of it, I just listened to that. I get, aside from Time After Time, Time right. After Time was a slam dunk.
Right.
But like I heard Girls Just Want to Have Fun coming out of my speakers and I'm like, I don't know. I just don't know. But obviously, I was wrong.
Okay, so that's a big success. How do the Hooters get signed?
A lot of it was on the strength of that. I mean, I think that gave Rick the ammunition he needed to be able to sign us.
So you basically owe your career to Rick.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And even more so, as the next chapter will reveal. But, we got a deal. We made the record. And, you know, All You Zombies was the first.
Well, we're now in the MTV era.
Yeah.
Okay, so when you started the Hooters, it was before that, because August of 81 is MTV. So how does that affect the creative process and what you end up doing?
Didn't affect our songwriting or our record making at all. I mean, we just figured somebody would come in and make a video.
So, okay, so you do All You Zombies, which becomes a huge hit.
It's funny. I think it peaked at number 57.
Yeah, but the numbers are irrelevant. Right. They played it all the right, time on right. the video channel. And then the next track comes out.
And we danced, which was really what made us go platinum.
Right. And now you're touring and you're living the life.
Living the life.
And do you believe that you've achieved your dream?
I was too busy to believe anything. You miss it the first time. You know, we weren't that young. I mean, I was already in my early 30s when this was happening. But, you know, it's such a whirlwind. I mean, we played Live Aid.
Right.
We opened Live Aid. You know, people ask me, what was it like? I don't know. We walked on stage. We did two songs. We were off.
Right. Do you hang out the rest of the day?
There were personal issues. I actually ended up going home for a few hours, and then I went back for the finale. But I was there for a fair amount of it.
Okay, so the first album comes out, goes platinum, and then where does that leave you?
When we toured a bunch, we opened for Loverboy.
Turn Me Loose.
Yep, and we opened for Squeeze.
Okay.
Don Henley for 2 weeks, Squeeze for a couple of months, and Loverboy. And then we have to make another album. And then Day by Day was the third single, which was actually the highest charting single.
Okay. But you have three hits, which by today's standards is gargantuan.
Yeah, well, actually four. Where Do the Children Go? The single didn't really do well, but the video was our highest charting video, number two, a live video. So then we have to make another record. And there's that, sophomore.
Right, of course.
Well, we've used all of our, but while we were on the road, we stayed busy. We're on a bus. I had a mandolin, and one day on a drive from New Orleans to San Antonio, I pick up the mandolin and start going. Et cetera, et cetera.
It's just that easy. It just comes to you.
Yeah, the brain and the fingers become one.
Okay, and you realize you've written something that's going to go.
I realize I've written something that's going to make me go for a while. The whole band was in the back lounge when we did that, and Rob's playing on the melodica, the Hooter, and it actually took us 6 months to write the song because a riff like that is just a riff. You got
right.
At some point you have to sing something, and I never thought the song actually came up to the level of that. I wish that we had found a way to sing that melody, but the words never came.
Okay, but that's the second album now.
That's the second album. So that we do the second album, we take a big chance. Accordions, mandolins, really going out, going for our ethnic weirdness thing. We've left the reggae thing behind at this point. We're staying with our God theme. All You Zombies is a Bible story.
Right.
And we write Satellite, which is about like Jimmy Falwell and that televangelist thing. So everybody thinks we're like a Christian band no, we're a couple of lapsed Hebrews
writing
this stuff. So the album comes out and it ships gold, which they took back from us because after the returns. Our first single from that album was Johnny B, which the video was directed by David Fincher.
Wow.
Yep.
Did you know he was going to turn into David Fincher?
Nobody knew who he was going to turn into David Fincher. And we toured with Bryan Adams on that album, but it never really caught hold in the U.S. Meanwhile, Germany happens. Johnny B is a smash, ubiquitous in Germany. But we go there and, wow, I can do this.
Okay.
Germany and Scandinavia.
But what does the label say?
Label says, that's great, but we got to do another album. So we go back and we've come off the road and we're a kick-ass band. I mean, we still are. We're more now than ever, really. It's a rock and roll show and the mandolins and the accordions make it rock even harder. We play at hard rock festivals in Europe now. We play between like Black Label Society and Ozzy.
Really?
Yeah. And people, when we pull out the mandolins and the accordions, they go nuts. They lose their minds.
So it's the energy that appeals to them.
It's the energy. It's the energy and it's the songs because we write real songs.
Okay, so you're making the third record.
Making the third record. I want to rock. We end up doing 500 Miles, a cover of 500 Miles, and we have Peter, Paul, and Mary sing on it with us. And it's kind of this lugubrious reggae vibe. The whole album ends up being our folkiest album yet. And I can't blame it on anyone. I signed off on every decision. That was the album that wanted to be made. It's like saying, I'm going to conceive and give birth to a nuclear physicist, and he turns out being a basketball player.
Right.
You just can't. Every song, every recording has a life of its own. It decides. The wand chooses the wizard.
Wand chooses the wizard. That's a good one. Yeah. Never heard that one before.
It's from Harry Potter.
Okay. Proves I haven't read it.
Oh, there you go. It's in the films, too. So we do our folkiest album yet. And at this point, Columbia basically drops us. I mean, they don't drop us, but, they pulled the plug on everything. We're touring places where we're selling out theaters. We're playing at clubs and strip malls. Nobody's coming. Nobody's playing the record on the radio. We're fighting on the bus. Then we get a call. We're going to Sweden. We're going to Stockholm. So March 90, we play the Concert House, Konserthuset in Stockholm, which is one of the most beautiful venues in the world. It's sold out. Everyone knows every word to every song. 500 Miles is a number one record there. And I was like, at this point, okay, we're a European band. We knew even then.
Okay, let's segue now to you becoming a songwriter, because 1990 was the year of Joan Osborne's album.
Joan came a bit later.
How long, what year was Joan Osborne?
Joan Osborne came out in 95.
Got it. I guess it's in the past and it's all blending together. Yeah. So at what point do you decide you're going to write songs for other people?
Rob and I did a bit of that. We did an album with Patti Smyth. We wrote some of the songs on that. We did Cindy's third album with her, and we wrote a lot of that. But Rick and Rob actually simultaneously found Joan in 93. She was playing at one of our manager's clubs in Philadelphia. And we decided to have her over and see what happened. And we clicked.
Okay, I love that album. She's never been able to follow it up with Ladder and all those other songs.
Yep.
But how do you write One of Us?
Okay, well, here's how you write a One of Us. It was like a laboratory. We would go in every day to our place. Anybody had an idea, we would develop it, try to make a real song. In the meanwhile, I've been on tour with the Hooters. I sit down on a plane, a flight from JFK to Stockholm, and this beautiful, obviously Swedish girl sits next to me. I ask her name in Swedish because I had a feeling it was going to come in really handy. And she says, I'm a Swedish girl with a Jewish name. Oh, Sarah. Well, I'm a Jewish boy with a Swedish name.
Eric.
And one thing leads to another. That January, she moves in with me. We're going to make the Joan Osborne record. She has my car, picks me up at one of our sessions. I have a guitar riff. You saw the thing with the fingers. I picked up a guitar at Rob's one morning, and I did this.
Wait, it just came out.
That's what happened. It's the riff du jour.
Okay.
That was the riff du jour.
Okay.
So that was in my head. I was playing it on the piano. In fact, when Sarah came to pick me up from the session, I was sitting at the piano playing it, and Joan was like riffing, doing her Joan bluesy riffing thing over it. Oh, maybe we'll make something out of that. So we go home, we have dinner, we watch The Making of Sergeant Pepper. You've seen that documentary. It's George Martin at that 4-channel.
Right.
So it ends, and Sarah says, wow, 4-track recording. What's that all about? I said, well, that crap on my dining room table, that's a 4-track recorder. Oh, record something for me, she says. So, okay, I've got this guitar riff. I have a little keyboard with, you know, drum sounds and bass sounds. So I make a little arrangement, a little track arrangement. Okay, I'll just arpeggiate it of chord changes, yeah. And then I'll go somewhere for the B section. Yeah. And I put together a little arrangement and recorded it. And she thought she'd be really impressed. And she's like, oh, that's cool. Now sing it. I'm like, sing it? What do you mean? You need a chorus. You need a title. You need a concept. Then you have to write verses. And then you realize that the verses don't fit the chorus, so you change the chorus. And then 2 weeks later, you realize you ruined the whole thing. And you start over. And eventually, you know, it takes some time here. Meanwhile, she falls asleep on the sofa, and I hear the voice of Brad Roberts from the Crash Test Dummies in my head singing, "If God Had a Name."
Right.
So, yeah, I've told you this before. So,
but tell everybody else.
Telling everybody else. I hit record, and I sang the song.
Sang the whole song.
I sang the whole song, except the last line of the chorus. I was stuck. Just a stranger on the bus. Da-da-da-da-da. And Sarah wakes up and goes, trying to get home. Stranger on the bus, trying to get home, trying to make his way home. Thank you. Go back to sleep.
Okay, you finished the song.
Finished the song, 1 a.m. My 5-year-old daughter's asleep upstairs. I go into our writing session the next day, have the little DAT tape with me, forget about the song. I forget that I've done it. Take a break in the afternoon. There might have been some herbal component to the break. And then I remember, oh, guys, I wrote this crazy thing. Pop it in. Rob pops it in. We were at Rob's at this point. Song ends. I look up. First, I see Rob, and he's sitting there with his arms crossed with that, oh, God, here's another one of Eric's weird songs. I look at Joan, and she's like, you know, okay, when can we get back to work? And Rick is just looking down in that deep Rick space that he gets into. He looks up, says, Joan, do you think you could sing that? He didn't say, do you want to sing that?
Right.
Because she probably would have said,
Right.
Do you think you could sing that? The story I tell is she said, I can sing the phone book right out the lyrics. I don't think she actually said that. She did say something about a phone book, but it wasn't in that context. But I wrote out the lyrics. I plugged the guitar in, and we just did a live-to-tape version with guitar and vocal. And we all just looked at each other and went, okay. And I remember that session ended. I got in the car, popped the cassette in, listened, and started writing the Grammy speech I should have gotten to give.
So you knew right away.
I knew. That voice, that was the voice that was born to sing that song, and that was the song that voice was born to sing.
Okay, now that song became ubiquitous to the point there was even a backlash.
Yeah.
Did you experience that as the writer?
No.
That's
that
good.
Great?
It all affected
Isn't that
her.
Great? Yeah, they protested Joan Osborne, the Catholic League, which turns out has nothing to do with the Catholic Church.
Oh, really?
Yeah, really.
I didn't know that.
I saw the guy interviewed on TV, and he says, I remember him saying, yes, you know, her album, there's lots of spirituality and sexuality, and it raises questions.
That's what a song does.
We'll have none of that here.
But, okay, you write a song of that magnitude. Do opportunities come to you?
Phone starts ringing off the hook. Desmond Child.
Okay.
This is where Desmond comes in. My buddy Glenn, who's sitting out there, met Desmond at a dinner in Miami, calls me and says, can I give Desmond Child your number? I'm like, are you kidding?
Right.
So Desmond calls me and he says, I've got this artist in London that I'm going to sign. I've got a song title, Kiss the Rain, and I want to write that song with you, and I want you to play your guitar like you played it on One of Us, and I want your lyrical quirkiness for this.
Okay.
And I said, well, cool, but I'm going to France next week for this songwriting thing at Miles Copeland's castle.
Right.
Oh, okay, I'll come. So he followed me there. And that's where we started the song. And then he lured me to London, where we finished it with Billy at the Halcyon Hotel.
Okay, how hard is it to write when you're given those prescriptions as opposed to waiting for inspiration?
I'll tell you how it happened.
Okay.
We were standing by a wall in the courtyard in the castle, and I pick up the guitar and go... And Desmond says, that's the chorus. We've just started Kiss the Rain.
Okay.
And it's cool. And so we went to London. I played that. And Desmond, you know, Kiss the Rain. That was, you know,
I love that record.
He knew. I do too. In fact, 90% of what you hear in that, we recorded on my then state-of-the-art Roland VS-880 in that hotel room in London.
So what are some of your other favorite sort of songs for hire that you've written?
I still like Old Before I Die, Robbie Williams' first single.
Okay. You know, we live in America where Robbie Williams never made it.
Right.
How big was that song in the UK?
Huge. Huge. All over Europe.
Okay. So you write these songs. We hear all these stories about the music business. Do you believe you were the deals were fair and you got the money you were entitled to?
I still have not seen a cent from our Sony records, our Columbia records. We're still in the red.
Wow.
I was a songwriter. I've always kept my publishing. So that was good. That continues to be good. You know, the balance is changing now because streaming favors the rights owners so.
Right. The songwriters are screwed in terms of percentage-wise with streaming.
It's draconian.
Okay. So do you now view yourself, you've had these successes, we're going back 20 years, to view yourself as a songwriter as opposed to a performer?
I'm a musician.
Okay.
You know, I'm a guitar player. I'm a singer when I need to be. I'm an entertainer. I love performing. I write songs because I need something to play.
And at this point in time, do you write the song and then find the artist? Or is it like with Desmond Child, hey, here's the title, here's the situation, write for this?
It's usually with the artist. You know, I had a great relationship with Amanda Marshall. I wrote almost all of her second album.
Right. Whatever happened to her?
You know, I stay in touch with her, and she had a nightmare thing with her management and with her record company, and she literally couldn't make music for 5 years. 6 years, and by then, but
I even saw her at the Troubadour. I was a huge fan.
I wrote 11 of the 13 songs on that second album and produced the singles. I loved her. I love her as a person. Her voice, she did things that were. I wept after she did the vocal for If I Didn't Have You, which is, I think, one of the best songs I've ever written.
Now, she did a song on the Tin Cup soundtrack. Were you involved in that?
No, that was earlier.
Okay. So, okay, you said you work with her. And any other situations recently?
Yeah. I mean, I've been writing with the Scorpions for 2003.
Okay, the funniest thing about the Scorpions went on their retirement tour. I think I know the age, and I think the retirement tour was 3.5 years ago. And then There've been two new albums since then.
It was 5 years ago, and I actually wrote the single from that album, which was called "The Best Is Yet to Come."
Right.
Should have been a clue.
So, you know, some people would say that's a huge journey from Joan Osborne, but I guess if you're a guitar player, it all works.
It's all music. You know, I've done a lot of folky stuff. I've done R&B. It's music. It's finding a melody and some words and finding a way to play it.
So how do you decide to get the Hooters back together, to get the band back together, as the cliche goes?
Well, we never broke up. The phone started ringing off the hook for me, you know, 95, 96. Rick signed us again to his label at Polygram, but the well had sort of run dry for Hooters songs. And Rob and Rick had this concept for an album called Largo, which was based on the Dvorak's epic journey across America. I wasn't feeling it. I didn't really get what the concept was. But the music was beautiful. It was ironic that on the heels of my biggest ever hit, which was totally lyric driven, I didn't write a word of lyric on the Largo album.
And it ultimately stiffed.
It did, which is a shame because it really did deserve to be heard, but there wasn't a real artist. You know, I did not want it to be called the Hooters. To me, it was not a Hooters record. The Hooters are a rock band. That was not supposed to be a Hooters album. It's a beautiful record. In fact, we performed it at Joe's Pub last year because Rick is on a mission to make a musical out of it. But there's no book. It's like it's kind of ass backwards. But God bless him. His tenacity is noteworthy. But you know, Rob wanted, you know, we had kids, we're raising our families. Rob wants to build a studio. I'm getting all these opportunities. And I wanted to do a solo record, which I did. I finally released that in 2000 to no acclaim, but
but I enjoyed it.
Thank you. You did. And you wrote a really nice thing about it.
Right.
Time just went by. All of a sudden we hadn't, you know, played in 6 years. And then we get a phone call from Pierre Robert at WMMR. He's celebrating 20 years. Would the Hooters get together and play at his anniversary concert? So we get on stage, we play 40 minutes before Fuel.
I know the band Fuel. Sure. It's a hard rock band.
Yeah. So we get on stage, you know, we rehearsed a couple of days, and I remember playing, looking around and going, have we been thinking, this is the best band I'll ever be in? I mean, I've played with the greatest musicians in the world, but this is the best band I will ever be in. And, you know, we had commitments through that summer. So, but finally, 2003, we went back to Germany. We toured all summer. And
how much do you work now?
Basically, it's a summer job.
Okay, and how many of the people are original people?
Well, our bass player's only been with us since 87.
Okay. And everybody else is original?
Everybody else is original, yeah. And we added a sixth member in 2010 because I broke my shoulder, didn't know if I'd be able to play skiing. Not a bad fall, but it was a snow ice snake under the powder.
Snow snake,
right. Snow snake. I landed on my elbow, snap. Didn't know if I'd be able to play, so we added friend who I always said, if I hurt myself, you're the call.
So can everybody make a living from their music from the Hooters?
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay. So if you achieve the dream.
Looking at it from above, of course, I've written a song that everyone in the world knows and loves.
Right.
I play in a band that plays as much as we want to, when we want to, where we want to. I still feel there's a bit of a restless thing. I feel like there's something I still haven't done that I'm going to do.
Right. And how hard are you working at it?
I am working it so hard. I'm, you know, now that I'm living in Stockholm, I'm in the center of the songwriting producing universe. So one day I'm writing a pop song. The next day I'm writing with a hard rock band.
So how does that actually, you work, there's a network or you had to create the network for yourself?
They come to me.
On that note, we have to end. You have come to listen to the Bob Lefsetz podcast with Eric Bazilian. We heard amazing stories about his band, Cyndi Lauper, other successes. Thanks so much for doing this,
Thank
Eric.
You, Bob. Always a pleasure.
Hi, this is Bob Lefsetz. I want to thank you for being a fan of my podcast. You can email me at bob@lefsetz.com and let us know what you think. We're open to all ideas. Be sure to subscribe at TuneIn, iTunes, or your podcast player of choice.